Hi, everyone. This is David Wilner. You're in for a treat today. Stay tuned for another edition of Renegade Radio. Welcome, first of all, Eve Harrow, who you probably all know from the Judean Eve show, and our guests, Baruch and Judy Sturman. Welcome to Renegade Radio, for lack of a better term. Right. So welcome, everybody. Eve, what's the date today?
The date today, well, we just figured out it was the 10th day of Shvat, 5773, January 21st. 2013, day before the elections in Israel.
So we got all kinds of things coming up. We got Tu B'Shvat coming up. We got the elections happening tomorrow, which is a national holiday, which is always fun. It's the closest thing I think we have to Sunday. And despite that, you guys have a clock ticking with all kinds of things happening this evening. So let's just jump right into it. You have recently produced a book called The Rarest Blue, which is, I think, unique for the kind of book that it is. It really is one of the most far-ranging books that I've read in a long time. It's all over the map, literally. And it includes archaeology and chemistry and a great detective mystery. Mm-hmm. And tell the listeners what got you into writing a book of this type.
Well, this is a story. It's actually a 4,000-year-old story that starts all the way back in Crete in the Minoans with the invention of shellfish dyeing. And, you know, it continues on throughout the Mediterranean and the Near East all the way until this very day when the story is actually still unfolding. And that's when we got involved in it, probably, I would guess, about 20 years ago, completely by accident. One of these serendipitous events where a good friend of ours invited us to go onto the beach to go scuba diving one day, and that changed our lives.
So let me just put a little context on the discussion. 20 years ago, it's actually more. It's close to 1979. So how many? That's 33 years ago.
Right.
No, wait. I'm going to get to you. Right? I was a student in Yerushalayim in yeshiva, and I was on a bus, and I saw a chassid wearing blue fringes on his tzitzit. And I said to him, "Where did you get that? I've never seen that before." I said, "Did you do that yourself?" And he said, No. This is Radziner Tchelet. This is from the Hasidic sect of Radzin." And I started wearing, I sent a letter to my Rosh Hashiva, and I said, "You know, what do you think about this?" He goes, "Well, I would do it myself, but people will look at me as if I'm a little bit funny. But you should go ahead and do it. If you're not embarrassed to walk around like that, go ahead and do it." And I went to Mea Sharim. I think it was around Sukkot time. And they were selling it at the Breslov Yeshiva. And they had just smuggled in Rabbi Nachman's chair into the country piece by piece and reassembled it in its glass booth, if anybody has gone to see the the chair there. And I bought my first pair of tchelet. And then I met Ari Greenspan, who told me, by the way, that's not the right stuff. So with that as a little bit of an intro, maybe, first of all, explain the commandment and the background and where we're headed with this conversation.
Okay, exactly. So even though to the world, this precious commodity, right, it was a beautiful blue dye, it's called tchelet in the Bible and also in Near Eastern languages, takiltu. So it was something that the world knew about, right? Like akin to gold or silver, something very, very beautiful and precious. And
because maybe I'll just interrupt for a second. Of course, in ancient times, clothes were the color of the sheep or the goats or the cows from whom they got the skin or the wool. There was no such thing as colorful clothes. When dyes were discovered, it was fabulous to the world. And certain dyes were discovered from berries, from flowers. You could make certain colors. But blue was very, very difficult to find. And when they discovered that the certain shellfish could create a dye and a lasting, strong dye, that changed the world. It became this incredibly valuable commodity equal to gold and silver and bronze and so on.
Exactly. And to the ancient Israelites, to the Jews, with the invention of monotheism, they took what to the rest of the world was something that implied status or something that was very, very expensive, something that was only for the rich. What they did is they consecrated it to the service of God. And so the temple The tabernacle in the wilderness is adorned with all of these curtains made out of these purple and blues. The purple was called argaman, and the blue was called tchelet. And the high priest wore clothes that were all of these beautiful blue tchelet. And every single Jew was commanded, and so it says in the book of Numbers, and you shall put on the fringes of your clothes one string of tchelet. Every Jew was commanded to wear this beautiful and luxurious, gorgeous string on their clothes. And that was to remind them of all of the other commandments in the Bible. It was their uniform, essentially, just like the high priest had clothes that were all tchelet, and so he was maybe the most sacred and the closest to God, and he had a lot of things to do that reminded him that were in the service of God. And the lay priest also had some tchelet on him, a belt made of tchelet, and he also had quite a bit of service to do. Every single person is commanded to wear this string to remind them that they also have obligations and a service to God. And what are those? To be an ethical person, a moral person, to keep all of the commandments. And that's what the blue string reminded them of.
And it also reminds, I think, us that we're a holy people. I mean, you even see it today. Royal purple, royal blue, right. Cardinal red.
Right. Mm.
And these clothes still till today show status. We've lost a little bit of it because now everyone wears colorful clothes.
Right.
But really, you see that in people who want to be dignified, who want people to even worship them to a certain degree, show it by their clothes. What's so cool for me, though, is that this fits in with other things that we were doing in the day, like with spices, by getting spices brought in that were very expensive at the time. That's also how we showed that Hashem meant so much to us. The ketoreth that we burnt, the incense that we burn, is another way of showing Hashem how much we believe in him and how much we care about him by going to tremendous lengths to procure things that would show that.
Exactly.
That's going to fit right in with that.
Exactly. And the Bible doesn't tell you that these things are not valuable, right? It's not an ascetic type of an approach that you should deny yourself or you should deny the fact that these things are beautiful and worthwhile. What it does say is that take them and use them properly and consecrate them. And that's really what monotheism is all
about.
That's what Judaism is.
So bring Kedusha, bring holiness.
Right. Exactly. It's elevating the world around us, the physical world around us, and bringing holiness
into the world.
Now, what we all agree is that this is a beautiful and important commandment. What's strange about it is that it was lost, completely and utterly disappeared, not only to the Jewish people, but to the entire world. Now imagine Julius Caesar, all of the emperors, Theodosius, Nero. All of the Roman emperors felt that this was the most important thing. The togas were of these purples and blues, and the generals wore them, and the temples and the courts of the kings were all adorned with them. And of course, to the Jews, this was such an important commandment. And yet, in the 7th century, it's gone. The Jews lost the secrets of this dye and the source of the dye, this sea snail, and the world lost the process
so
as well.
Just before you go down that path, right? And I've gone snorkeling, in Dore, and I've seen the process, and we'll talk about the process in a minute. But it's an obscure process. In other words, you're not going to stumble upon how to utilize this secretion from this mollusk or from this snail by accident, right? And you've now been involved with this for a long time. What's your sense? Is this something divine? Is this something that somebody figured out? How did we come to know as a people about the chilazon?
It's a great question, and no one can really ever know what happened. But it does. In every culture, there are legends and myths about how this was discovered.
You talk about the Liberian myth.
There's a beautiful Liberian myth about how indigo was discovered. Mm-hmm. And because of the almost magical properties of the colors changing from one color to another color during the dye process, and like you mentioned, how sensitive they are to different parameters, for all of these reasons, people felt that this could never have been something that was stumbled upon, and all of the myths believe and attribute it to some kind of a gift from the gods. There's one beautiful legend in Tyre, the Tyrian purple, and there are coins that show the dog of Hercules with a little snail close to his mouth. And the legend goes that Hercules, or Melkarth, as he was called in Tyre, was walking along the beach with the nymph of Tyre. And Hercules' dog was running along ahead of them, frolicking in the waves, and came back with his mouth stained a beautiful purple purple dye.
Purple
color that no one had ever seen before. And of course, the nymph of Tyre said to Hercules, please, I need this. You must make me a...
Otherwise.
And some guys will do anything for exactly. a nymph.
Especially, right. Especially if you're Hercules. And of course, this was easy for him. And he figured out, what did he do? He ran after his dog. And the dog showed him the snail that he had bitten into. And that's, of course, how it was discovered that these snails could produce the beautiful dyes that they do.
You know, what's interesting is that we're not allowed to eat snails.
Yes. Like it's a non-kosher animal.
So it's like Dafka, something that it's very clear that we're really not supposed to. We couldn't have stumbled on it like on the dinner plate, you know, maybe like the French do with escargot.
Right. But you're probably right, Eve. That's probably the way that originally this was found. You know, even in the archaeological excavations, it's always a big question. Were the shells that were found, were they part of the dye or were they part of the diet? Mm-hmm. So that's the question. And usually it's when you find a few snails, you're assuming that they ate them. When you find a lot of snail shells, and you're assuming that they did some sort of dyeing with them. But that's probably what happened. Somebody was cooking the dyes or was eating them under certain conditions.
Stained their dentures. Yeah,
exactly. And that's probably how they stumbled across them. And again, it's very, very early. We're talking about 1750 BCE.
Early Bronze Age.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Abraham's time. Right. Yep. Patriarchal period.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Yeah. Okay.
Very cool.
Well, as I mentioned, these dyes get lost completely. And now that's so strange, again, because it's something that was... very, very important and sacred to the Jewish people. And it was something that was important to the entire Roman world, especially.
Economically. They were worth the cornerstone of their industry.
Exactly. They were worth up to 20 times their weight in gold. You can imagine if somebody one time would come to you and say, you know, like imagine 1,000 years from now, people say, you know, they had this thing in the ancient times. It was called oil. I don't exactly know what it was. You know, nobody knows what it was, but it was something that was...
Something so valuable. Something so dear.
People would go to war for it.
They say it was very important to those people in those days. You know, that's exactly what we're trying... Okay. So how could this possibly have happened that it got lost, such an important technology and such an important commodity? And it has to do with the fact that it was so important and so expensive. And it was, of course, like anything, came under imperial control. The government wants, talk about big government. The Roman government was about as big as you could get.
Right.
So they wanted a piece of the action. They wanted not just a piece of the action. They wanted all the action. And the dye houses came under complete imperial control, utter and total imperial control. Anybody who was caught not just dyeing this or not just selling it, but owning it, even having it in their house, according to Theodosius and Justinian, that was tantamount to treason, and they could be put to death for just owning this kind of material. So to the Jews in impoverished Palestine in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, it's very, very expensive, and they don't have the money to – they can't afford it. It's rare because in order to find this kind of stuff, you had to go to the dye houses that weren't under their control, and it's dangerous. And so the Talmud even says there's a story about these two
– The eagle.
Right, exactly. There are these two, I guess you would call them students, who were trying to smuggle Tehillat out of Israel and into Babylonia, and they were caught by the eagle, and of course the Talmud is using this as a metaphor for Rome. And just by a miracle they were saved, but that means that it was dangerous, but yet the Jews tried as best as they could to keep
You can imagine probably one set of Tehillat was handed down from father to son, precious within the family.
So let's talk about that for a second. How many snails do you need to dye one set of tzitzit, one garment?
So we today, with all of the modern conveniences that are available to us and our knowledge of chemistry, it takes us about 60 snails to make the strings that are needed for one prayer shawl, for one tallit. 60 snails. I would guess in ancient times that was probably an order of magnitude more. So probably hundreds of snails that were needed just to make, you know, the few threads.
Maybe we should just mention that it comes from a gland within the snail. So you're talking about a little tiny snail shell, and inside there is a tiny creature, and inside him is a tiny gland, and that gives us a tiny amount of dye.
And you can only get it from the living snail. You can't so you can't really harvest them, allow them to die, and then
Exactly.
Die. Yeah. Die and die.
Right. Yeah. Everything, the processes are very, very sensitive, and so probably, you know, I don't know, how many times out of... out of the dye, you know, when you attempted to dye, it didn't work right. You know, even for us now today, when we're doing this under controlled conditions, it still doesn't work right very, very often. Mm-hmm. And so all of this was true. Very rare, very expensive, very difficult. And then The final blow probably came in the 7th century with the conquest of Palestine. I think Israel was conquered, I think, no less than four times in the span of 20 years, around the year 614, 620.
It was horrible.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
And I think Jerusalem was conquered maybe, I don't know, 17 times, some ridiculous thing like that. And the last of the conquerors were the Arabs and...
The Muslims.
And they, of course, their sworn enemy were the Romans, and anything that had to do with Rome, they utterly destroyed. And of course, the dye houses were.
Well, but by that point, it's really Byzantium, right? There, it's the Christian Empire of Rome.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the Arabs basically chased the Byzantines and the Romans up the Mediterranean all the way to Constantinople. And as they did, you know, the dye houses were destroyed. And so the entire world lost essentially this important technology.
So let's sidebar here for a second, because I always like to have the archaeological spin on things. And there's a lot of archaeology in the book. I've been to Dor, and I've excavated a number of places along the coast. In Dor, there are thousands of shells piled up together. You have a little museum there that's been there for a number of years already. But in places like Yavne, we found Chilazon shells, and other places we have found them, but always very few, not in mass quantities. So, I mean, you can explain that for a lot of reasons. I like one of the theories about how you authenticated or knew that it was a legitimate place to sell.
Like an advertisement.
Right, mm-hmm. That you had right. That in your window, so to speak. But one of the things that intrigues me is that if you have a manufacturing process and you're literally dealing with thousands and thousands of shells all the time, and at the same time, we know that the Talmud talks about once every 70 years or once every 7 years that they come up, and they're not snorkeling. Okay, I mean, these people were not snorkeling 2,000 years ago, right? How are they trapping? How are they acquiring the enough and sufficient quantities of the raw shell of the live shells in order to put this into production?
Like, could they raise them, or they had to go into the sea and get them?
Well, strangely enough, or maybe not so strange, they're doing it exactly the same way that we do it today. So they would bait baskets, right? These snails, one of the things that they all have in common is that they're carnivorous. So they eat meat or snails or fish or whatever they do. So if you put a little bit of bait into a basket and lower the basket onto the seabed for a few days, when you bring it back up, it'll be covered with snails, and that's still the way that we do today. We catch these snails.
Cool.
And if you do enough baits, you'll get enough snails. But what you mentioned before, David, is true. These snails had to be kept alive then until you would break them open and extract the glands. And so in Dor, for example, you have these huge holding pens that are just under the water level, and it seems, at least this is what we're surmising, is that they would keep all of the snails in there, and when they had enough and they, you know, to die, then they would
area of the beach,
like exactly world. in the world.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things, one of the reasons that, you know, or at least we suspect that this could be true, is because the snails, when they're regular in the water, happy as can be, they're going around
happy as a clam.
They're going around and they're finding their natural food stuff, barnacles or and whatever. They actually have a very, very ingenious way of attacking them, because they all have shells. All of their prey have shells, small snails. So they have a little, it's like a little trunk that they can extend and drip hydrochloric acid onto their prey, and they can actually bore through the shell and then they can kill the snail, and they can okay, so they're amazing little chemical factories.
Unbelievable.
In any event, when they're normal and happy and everything is going well, they'll eat, you know, whatever other clams or snails are around. When they're in captivity and there's no other food, they'll eat each other. But only when they're in captivity and there's no other food around. So if you can find a murex snail shell — these are murex, the types of snails that we're talking about — if you can find one with a little bore that's maybe a millimeter or two, a beautiful little hole,
perfect hole,
then you know it was eaten by another murex, and that means it was...
Wow, which fits in with elections tomorrow.
If only we could drop hydrochloric acid on certain...
So I know this is a family show, but I have to ask, are there male and female snails, and how do they procreate?
Oh, yes.
Is there a difference in the dye?
There's a chapter in the book about that, but I haven't gotten it yet.
Yes, it's actually a phenomenal a study. Not just are there male and female snails.
But how
it's
would
not
you tell?
Clear.
Okay, really?
Yeah, well, normally you could just take a quick look at the J-shaped penis. However, the females will often grow one of those because maybe of pollution.
They switch. They flip.
Exactly. They're hermaphroditic.
Sort of. Right.
They're, so they are both, they are cannibals, carnivores, and hermaphrodites.
Aldemilus, as my grandmother would say.
Beautiful. All in one little tiny
right.
shell.
But we actually made a connection with an Australian marine biologist, Kirsten Benkendorf, who spends her time researching these snails, and particularly the difference in the molecules that they produce, the females and the males.
Sex life of snails.
Basically.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Which you can't
imagine. It's a very slow read.
I'll tell you.
Let's see how many puns we can get about shells and snails.
Yeah, that's the blue chapter.
So they're also in Australia then?
Well,
she may be working in a lab. I'm not sure.
But the Murex snails are all over the world. There's over 1,000 species, 1,000 different
variety,
species of...
With the dye?
Yes, and all of the Murexes have the dye. There are three different species live in the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. right? As some of the earliest researchers found.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in any event, so she is doing her research on all of this, and you'd imagine this is as arcane as you could possibly imagine, the snail sex and the molecules produced.
Nobody buys the book for the pictures. Right. So yeah. Here she is, yeah.
And, however, Kirsten and her lab have found that some of these molecules have unbelievable healing properties, really? Not just homeopathic, which they do, and they've been used for many, many years in homeopathic medicine, but they've actually been pointing the way towards certain research in certain types of cancers.
Wow.
That these that these molecules are helping to elucidate and to.
Well, I remember my late father-in-law, who was an old-time GP. He used to paint everything with gentian violet. Didn't matter what was wrong with you, you got gentian on.
So that's the 2,000-year-old man routine about blueberries. You know, you go in, you stain the tubercular cells, and that way you know how to get rid of it with blueberries. But anyhow, so anything that stains the cells.
That's fascinating, except that it would be so difficult to put that out in amounts, right?
Well, once you understand the molecules, then you could potentially synthesize them. And in fact, you know, it's interesting if you just point out the connection between dyes and drugs. When over the last 100, 200 years, since Perkin started investigating all of these dyes, the drug
synthesizing
mm-hmm. them, right? So he discovered mauve, right? That was a big thing, famous.
Accidentally discovered.
Right. And then there's mauve, yes. Right.
And he was.
Do you know what mauve is? Most men don't know mauve.
I'm a graphic designer. Color is my life.
Right. A purplish, pinkish color that became the huge hit in London when he discovered it.
Which he discovered, and he made, of course, a huge, huge fortune. Yeah. But he was actually looking
green.
Yeah. But he was looking for a drug. He was looking for quinine, and he missed that. Mm-hmm. But the opposite ended up happening. They took these dyes and tested them on every possible type of disease, and a lot of what we've found today, a lot of the antibiotic industry has come out of that research that was done on dye. So the dye, chemistry, drugs, they're all related.
Okay, so we are now in a period where we're after the Muslim conquest, just to put us back on our timeline, and the knowledge and the science and quickly falling out of human, I would say, purview.
Right.
And now we're going to go through a long period where we're not going to have this particular color fast dye available to the world. And people start substituting other things in place of it. So let's pick up there from the Muslim
conquest. The Karaites, for example, who show up in the 8th century.
Right.
And they feel that the point was to have a blue thread, not to have it necessarily come from an animal.
Right.
So they start using indigo.
Yes,
that's right. And for the secular world in general, the fact that we lost the snail dye was not particularly significant because there was a plant dye, indigo, that they were able to replace it with.
Which is genius.
And that, exactly. And that, again, became hugely popular and a major point of
the
economy and so on. But for the Jewish world, mm-hmm. there was the tradition that it had to come from the source, from the shell source, from the chilazon, the way that the Talmud speaks about. The shell.
And
I just want to point out that probably any variety that produces from the chilazon, from any of the Murex family, is probably acceptable for dyeing. Would you agree with that?
I would say exactly that. And it has to come from some sort of a sea creature, the sea snail, and it has to be a color that's similar to the sky, so it would be some sort of a blue. And the most important thing, or one of the most important things, it has to be steadfast. It never faded, it never got washed out, not by detergents, not left in the sun. And these were the major characteristics of this tchelet that had been lost. So why did people start even thinking about it? For traditional Jews, they had their white strings mm-hmm. on their prayer shawls, and great men and had been wearing them for many, many generations. But in the middle 1800s, when Jews started thinking about returning to Zion, returning to Israel, and of course, to religious Jews, that meant rebuilding the temple. And when you rebuild the temple, of course, you want to do the service in the temple, which requires the proper clothes. And those clothes require the tchelet. So the early stirrings of Zionism were those same motivations behind an attempt to start looking for tchelet again. And the only way you could find it again was to find this mysterious...
To identify the source of the blue dye.
Sea creature. And when I was growing up, and I would imagine this is the way most people felt about it, it was like one of these creatures. It was from legend, the Chilazon. What does that mean even? Probably exists in some other dimension, on another planet.
Magical creature.
Yeah, magical mm-hmm. creature, right. But really, it was something real.
Well, because we have the Shamir, which is right, mythological. Exactly. So people automatically,
The stones for the temple.
And Bilam's talking donkey. We have these kinds of magical creatures in Jewish liturgy.
Exactly.
But this is not that. This is something different.
To many people, it was that, and it was mm-hmm. something that could never really, maybe it was, God would show it to us, or the Messiah, or who knows
what. Well, maybe he has.
But there was one person who took it very, very seriously and decided that he was going to go out and look for this creature, and he was, of course, the great Radziner Rebbe of Gershon Henoch Leiner, scion to a very, very important Hasidic dynasty that traces itself back to the Rabbi of Kutsk. And,
it's a great story that you tell. Yeah. I mean, it's a famous story, but if you're not in the Hasidic world, you probably don't know it.
Yeah.
Maybe quickly tell that story.
I'll leave the story.
Leave that for the book.
Let's leave some things for people to read.
It really is a great story. It really is a great story. And we've come to so appreciate this Radziner rabbi, great men. What was unbelievable about him, he was brilliant, of course. Okay, so a lot of rabbis, you always have these stories about people who, when they were 4 years old, they knew everything there was to know. He was completely self-taught, but not only everything that had to do with religious studies. He had he was a pharmacologist, and he would write prescriptions that the Polish authorities recognized. He designed a flour mill, and he's an engineer.
Poland, maybe. The European Union is another story.
He just an amazing, amazing man. And he decided one day to pick himself up, leave his flock of tens of thousands of Hasidic followers. He, his son, and some shamish, his butler, picked themselves up, went across the entire continent to Naples in Italy, to the great aquarium that had just been opened.
The first aquarium ever opened to the public.
Yep. And he sat there.
Timing is everything.
And he sat there for a year looking at all of the different creatures, all of the different fish, all of the different sea cucumbers and everything that was there, anything that was in the Mediterranean that he could look at and examine, and tried to decide which of these could possibly be this long-lost source of tchelet, and found a creature, and the creature was a very cute, adorable little fish. It's called a cuttlefish.
Strange looking.
Yes. That's with T's, not with D's, but it's close enough. Right? Yeah.
Sepia, which had been known for many, many years to produce a very beautiful dye.
But it's usually a brown
ink
color.
That's
Sepia
right.
is a brownish
the ink that
color.
It shoots.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's true. But, that might be a problem for mortal men like me and you, David. But I think the rabbi, your Gershon Henoch, that was not anything that could stop him. Yeah. And he figured out how to turn that brown dye into a blue dye.
Don't make your brown eyes blue. That's it.
Brown dyes blue.
That's it.
Very good. Yes,
that actually was an old Hasidish song.
Carly Bach was going to make a song tune to that.
Go figure.
Yeah. And he did, and he came back triumphant to his town of Radzin in Poland, and within a year, tens of thousands of Hasidim were wearing his dyes, his blue tchelet, but it didn't catch on. But
it didn't spread beyond their community. Their group. Why do you think that was?
Well, there are many, many reasons. As any good Hasidish Rebbe, he had many enemies. And so sometimes the attacks against his tchelet were political and not necessarily to the point. But there were real issues that were raised. Radzin tchelet washes out. That's a problem.
Now you'll still see Reziner Hasidim nowadays. That's what you wore.
I have a bag still sitting because at that time when Ari told me that, it got put on the side and I didn't put tight onto anything.
Right.
But it's still even in the bag. You can see that the color is coming off on the bag.
Right. The color
is not color fast.
Right. It's not color fast. And then another problem that people raised was that these squids or these cuttlefish were being brought back dead and kind of frozen. All the way from Naples to Radzin, and then processed there. And of course, we mentioned before, the tradition was that it had to be from alive, that it could only be from alive, or else it wouldn't work from a live animal.
So it didn't fit the criteria.
It didn't fit the criteria. And there were people that actually raised these issues, and the Radzin Rebbe was a brilliant, brilliant man, and he answered them. And it was a big argument back and forth. But again, it didn't catch on mostly. And eventually, in 1914, I would say the real hero of our story, Rabbi Isaac Halevi Herzog, another man who is just, you could talk about him forever, wrote his doctorate in 1914 on Hebrew porphyrology, which is a word he invented. The study of purple. And the study of purple in the ancient...
We're the purple people. Skula.
Yes.
Oh, I like that.
Is purple.
That's good, Eve.
Nice.
Yeah, if I ever have another radio show, I'm calling the purple people. I've already decided that.
My favorite book as a kid was Harold and the Purple Crayon. Okay.
Anyway, Rav Herzog, who again we could talk about him just forever and ever. He was the chief rabbi in Dublin during the War of Independence, and he became very, very good friends with Sinn Féin and learned actually a lot from them. Had very long discussions about what it means to have a democracy which also has a specific religious character, and a lot of what he discussed there, he applied when he became eventually the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel, and wrote a lot about that.
He was also self-educated.
He was self-educated.
A brilliant man. Yeah. Several doctorates. Spoke many languages.
Yeah.
And had no problem meeting with all of the world leaders. He met with Roosevelt. He met with Truman. Again, just a larger than life figure. Although he was quite short. I mean, he put together him and the top hat that he wore, and he was still short. But nonetheless, a formidable person who researched the entire topic. And essentially proved, and we're not going to get into it, but essentially categorically proved that this Radzin Tehillet could not have been the authentic Tehillet, and made other suggestions. He did believe that it came from a snail, and the Murex trunculus snail, which is what we believe it came from, he thought that it did come from that snail, but he had one major problem. All of the archaeological evidence he had and he knew about, and that really would have swayed him, the problem was it dyed purple and not blue. And
that's a problem.
It's a big problem.
When you're looking for blue.
Right. And, we talk about the challenges or the conflict between religion and science. And most people back down from that. Meaning when you have some kind of a conflict between what science tells you and what religion tells
you. They compartmentalize two different worlds, and we're not going to allow them to.
Or else in the best case, they'll say, well, religion didn't really mean that. And science is true, and we have to figure out how to.
Right.
Rav Herzog would not do that. He had all of the chemists, all of the archaeologists, all of the historians, everybody on the side that give it up. Tehillet was purple. It was violet. It had a blue-purple color. And we can prove it, and we have all of the, all of the proofs from everywhere.
In the olden days, the ocean was blue, with purple, and blue. Right.
And Rabbi Herzog said, no, our tradition says blue, and he could never resolve that conflict. Mm-hmm. And that resolution came after he
passed away
in 1959, and the serendipitous discovery of how to actually, at what point, and what you need to do during the process that could... that could actually change this.
So let's explain the process now. What goes into it? I've now harvested the live shell from the sea. What do I have to do in order to get the dye out of it?
Okay, you got your snail. You break it open at just the right point. You break the shell and push the little worm that lives inside the shell out of the little hole. Snip off the particular gland that we're looking for and collect the glands. And then you... you're ready to dye with them. But there's a problem, because the dye does not dissolve in water. So in order for it to dissolve in water, you have to do something. It's a particular chemical process called reduction. And that will allow you to dissolve the dye into water. And then once it's in that state, you can introduce it into you can introduce it into the wool. Okay, so that's essentially what we have to do. Only for dying process. I haven't talked about anything else. You have to get it into this particular state, and then it can be introduced into the wool. At that particular moment, when it's in that state, if you expose it to sunlight, then it will change from being purple to being blue. And that's something that Rabbi Herzog didn't know. That's something that no one knew until
but
around
1985. But you have to assume that the ancients did know that, because where did they do the dying? Yeah. They did it outside on the beach. You didn't bring the smelly fish and everything.
No.
That this sun is the key component?
But it was a closely guarded secret.
Yeah. Number one and number two. But it would have been natural for them also, because they were doing it outside.
But what is it in the sunlight? Is it the ultraviolet radiation that's causing the... It's a photoreaction, I assume.
Yes.
Right? So it's interesting that it's an ultraviolet process that's triggering this change. Okay.
Right.
So you can freeze along that spectrum the color where you want it.
Right.
That's right. And they probably did get different shades and different tones and so on.
Exactly.
And they appreciated that. They were able to see the difference between blues and purples and so on. And they played with that, I'm sure.
Exactly. The underlying chemistry is based on this indigo molecule. And indigo is blue. But when the snail attaches to this indigo a couple of bromine atoms, it can turn either a reddish purple or a deep purple, a violet purple. It has all of these different spectrums depending on whether it's one bromine molecule, two bromine molecules, depending on what the snail is in the mood for that day. But the ultraviolet breaks off the bromine from the indigo, and you're left just with that beautiful, pure blue, sky blue color. And that's a trick that we know the ancients knew how to do. We have fabrics that are found that are 2,500 years old that were dyed with shellfish, and the pattern is clearly blue in some places and purple in other places.
Deliberately.
So they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. They knew a lot of what they were doing.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you're manufacturing today, do you use sunlight or do you use an ultraviolet bulb? I mean, what do you do to lock in the color where you want it?
Yeah, we try as best as we can to use sunlight only because that's what works the best. But in the winter, it's a little bit difficult. We don't have as much sunlight as we want, so we have all these kinds of things that we're trying to do. The other day, we were in the factory, and I had one of these projectors sitting on top of the dye vat, you know, trying to project as much light as possible into it to see if we could get it to turn the right colors. It's kind of a little bit of a
you're still working on it.
Yeah.
Work in progress.
We're like mad scientists there in the laboratory trying to work on it.
I just have to say that for me, and this is a little bit where my head goes, what this, and that's why it's so amazing, and I know I speak for David also, that we're friends with you. Like, you're just this lovely couple, you know, like you look normal, but you have been a part of bringing something back to the Jewish people that for me is totally Hashem's hand in here. And we have come home to Eretz Yisrael, no snails in Babylon, no snails in Teaneck. It's all a part of, I think, Eretz Yisrael welcoming us back to the Jewish people. The beginnings of the Geula, whatever we want to call it, that all these things that were lost for so many years while we were lost are now coming back. Like I said, you know, some of the Far Simon, the spices that are coming back, and someone's now, made lechem panim, you know, he's learned how to bake it. And there's all these things suddenly. It's like science. Talk about maybe there's a dichotomy between science and religion, and what you're doing is bringing it together. I mean, for me anyway, science is a sign of Hashem's hand in the world, who made all the laws of physics and all this. Anyway. But it's like, it's coming back. It's a rebirth in so many ways, a tangible rebirth. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful time. And what you're doing is just so amazing.